Hello! Welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and my guest today is a return guest. His name is Sanjay Rawal. He is a filmmaker, a documentarian, who makes really beautiful, heartfelt, important movies about seemingly random topics. So he was on the podcast previously talking about a movie called 3100, which involves people running 3,100 miles around a city block in New York. And his new movie is called Gather. And it's the intimate portrait of a growing movement among Native Americans to reclaim their spiritual, political, and cultural identity through food sovereignty, all the while facing and healing their collective trauma caused by centuries of genocide. It's a big topic. It's heavy. But it's really good, it's really powerful, and Sanjay is just fascinating as a human being. And in this episode, we talk about the earth, humility, we talk about colonialization, we talk about indigenous cultures, talk about the importance of taking our power back, changing the world, all good things. I think you're going to dig it, I think you're going to dig him, and without further ado, Sanjay Rawal. All right, Sanjay Rawal. Welcome back to the podcast.
Oh man, pleasure to be here.
It's like our annual catch up.
Yeah.
So last time you were here, for those who are listening, Sanjay is a, well, Sanjay, who are you? What do you do? How do you describe yourself?
I mean, the simplest way of saying things is I make movies. I make full length documentary films that are 60, 70, 80, 90 minutes long. Hopefully they're entertaining enough for people to watch 60, 70, 90 minutes.
Yeah. I've watched two of them and I've made it through to the end of both.
Good. That's what I love.
So the first movie that you came on to discuss is called 3100, and it was about a race in New York City where people run 3,100 miles.
The world's longest race. People have to run 3,100 miles. And for the international listeners, that's just a hair less than 5,000 kilometers. And they do it all around a 1 kilometer or slightly more than half a mile long loop in the center of New York City. This year, because of COVID and the fact that, you know, New York was the epicenter of the universe when the race would normally start in June, the race was moved to Salzburg, Austria. And it actually started there on September 13th. And five people have entered, and they found a park in Salzburg where people are running 1.01 kilometers, 4,800 times through the fall.
That is wild to me. That movie is a trip. I recommend, if you're listening, check that out, especially if you're a runner. It's not necessarily about running. It's deeper. And I think that that's one reason I enjoy your art, is that you seemingly take a very small, simple thing and turn it into a much larger meaning. Does that make sense? Does that resonate at all? Do you try to do that?
You know, like as we talked about on the last pod, you know, like you, my background is spiritual. And, you know, I moved to New York to study with the Indian guru, Sri Chinmoy. And I was coming right out of college, so I didn't know anything about anything. So everything I can say I do now, career-wise or work-wise, has kind of come from that fundamental interest in self-discovery. And so even though some of my films are about human rights, some of them are about athletics, I try to make sure that at the core of each film, there's a spiritual basis. In fact, it's like when I pick my next film, the film has to be something that I know will occupy me and interest me for the 3, 4, 5, 6 years that it takes to make a film. And that's not going to come from a topic. Like, it's not going to be like, you know, an octopus, like that great movie, My Octopus Teacher. It's going to come from a feeling that I have, and that feeling is going to be rooted in something spiritual so that I can actually make progress myself while trying to make a movie.
Mm. Okay. And so maybe that's a good segue to your current film. Is that right? You say your current film, the newest one?
The latest one out the door. Yeah.
The latest one out the door. It's called Gather.
And I actually cut and pasted a sentence to try to summarize this. So it's an intimate portrait of the growing movement of Native Americans to reclaim spiritual, political, and cultural identity through food sovereignty while battling the trauma of centuries of genocide.
In a nutshell, the film is exactly that. And for those interested, it's on iTunes and Amazon in the US, UK, and Canada, and then Vimeo on demand everywhere else. But why would I do a film like this when I'm not Native American, right? And it's a very, very tricky space to be in because Natives have been exploited by filmmakers since the very first documentary in 1929 called Nanook of the North, where this American dude, Robert Flaherty, basically invented an Inuit story, cast some Inuit people, and it started a snowball rolling down the hill. But I had a great Native producer. I had a great set of Native crew, so we kept things as indigenous as possible. So that's just a prelude to say, like, until about 400 or 500 years ago, and for some communities much, much more recently, we weren't really nomadic as people. Or if you were technically nomadic, you knew where you were, you know, going, but it was very rare for someone to move from LA to Vancouver. It was very rare for someone to move from, like, Oakland, where I grew up, to New York. Like, we wouldn't move 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 miles. Yes, there were some populations, especially those that were constantly persecuted, like Ashkenazi Jews, that, you know, every six or seven generations had to totally uproot themselves. So with the exceptions of those small pockets of movement, most of our ancestors lived in areas for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And if you think about the human body, it's pretty resilient to temperature. I mean, you could wear a jacket and you'd be fine, you know, above the Arctic Circle. You could wear undies and you'd be fine, like, on the equator. But if you grew up above the Arctic Circle and you couldn't ingest large amounts of fat, you were dead. Like, they eat a lot of fat and that's all there is. And you wouldn't pass on your genes. So the genes that your ancestors gave you were highly specific to certain environments. And it wasn't the temperature variation of those environments, it was the food. If you were living in a place and you couldn't digest the food that was around you, you were dead. So when we think about the strength, the genetic strength that we have, it's all based on adaptations to food. Now, all of that disappeared, you know, when the Europeans came, you know, looking around the world for stuff. And they started migrating in massive populations. And they started taking stuff like tomatoes and potatoes and corn, things that were strictly Western Hemisphere products for 50,000 years or longer, and started taking them to Europe. Now, Italy's all about tomatoes. India didn't have hot pepper until the 1650s. So this kind of global capitalist, extractive, colonial economy didn't just spread people, it destroyed people, of course, to try to get the land under them and the value of that land, but it took a lot of things around the world. So fast forward to 2020, 2021, we're all pretty much eating the same thing, depending on the country that we're in. And so many of us living in countries are not indigenous to these countries. You know, 400, 500 years doesn't make us indigenous here. So we're all eating stuff that we don't necessarily have a genetic predilection to. And the last thing I'll say is, in this day and age, if you can't survive a childhood diet high in sugar, high in salt, high in fat, you're dead. You get diabetes, you can't pass on your genes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my movie Gather looks at the original people of Turtle Island, of North America, and looks at the tremendous variety of food that they'd created in the ecosystems they'd nurtured for millennia, and looks at the subsequent destruction of those food systems as European colonists came in, and now the revival of those movements to get rid of diabetes, to get rid of obesity, to revive the genetic strength of Native Americans.
And so why this topic for you? You're like a filmmaker in New York City. You're like making movies, and then like what grabbed you? I'm just curious.
Also, like, you know, on the West Coast right now, as we're recording this podcast, there are a massive amount of massive number of fires covering mm-hmm. millions of acres. Mm-hmm. And people are arguing, I think incorrectly, that this is a function of climate change. It's not. It's a function of erasing people from the climate, meaning that for tens of thousands of years, indigenous Californians, Coloradoans, West Coast natives exquisitely managed those forests through you know, conscious burns, through using wildfire as medicine for those forests, for the healing power that fire had in those environments. And the prescription to recovering in the West is not to allow massive 2 million acre fires to happen, but to have more prescribed burns. And that is a direct recognition of the indigenous wisdom that made those ecosystems so healthy. So when I look at things like that, when I look at the commodification of the food system, it's not because of the forces of capitalism and or climate change alone. It's because we're erasing people that are experts, and we're erasing them based on greed, based on racism, based on some dark things. I mean, it's the craziest thing. I'm a part of all of this too, right? I don't have ancestral roots in America, but when colonists go anywhere, they immediately try to transport their own farming system, their own food system to that place rather than learn about what made that environment healthy. So a long way to answer your question is that, you know, I look at the food system in America, and I've made a movie on this about farm workers and the supply chains of supermarkets called Food Chains. I've watched all these great movies about fungi, about certain elements and, you know, silver bullets that will change your life. But it negates the actual solutions to these big problems. The actual solutions are complicated, and they involve really valuing people. And in this case, it means really valuing the indigenous people who knew the environment of North America and who still have that knowledge. So I kind of looked at Make and Gather as a prescription for us saving the world from ourselves.
Just that.
Just that. I want to survive. I want to live, you know, past the 2030s.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's going to happen until the people that were original stewards of this land are allowed to do what they were always meant to do. Mm. And until we start learning that our place here is as stewards and not as occupiers or as people just extracting resources.
Mm. It seems like more and more we're kind of progressing back to where we used to be in the sense of organic farming, small communities, tribal systems, etc.
Exactly. And the fallacy of all of it is just like the fallacy in most Western approaches to spirituality, that like it, when by that I mean like the notion that the guru is within, that rather than doing the hard work of finding a teacher and listening to that teacher and absolving or negating our ego in order to like learn from a master, as one would do in really any traditional spiritual practice. You know, there are folks in North America that have been practicing, quote, permaculture for tens of thousands of years. And chances are the people that have developed these new modern localized systems have actually appropriated from Native Americans. They might have read some book or learned some technique and they're trying to recreate it. Whereas there are systems in indigenous North America where these concepts are fully functioning. And if we went with the spirit of learning, we'd do a much better job in this so-called return.
Mm. And so when you started your movie, did you start by approaching various indigenous communities for ideas or support? Or how do you begin this process?
Ooh, good question. So again, it's like as a non-native, I know that there's a deep amount of mistrust amongst Native Americans, in Indian country, as it's called, just because there's been so much exploitation. For example, you know, 100 years ago, the Hopi who live on ancestral territory in what's now Arizona, you know, they've got varieties of corn that don't need any water. They just dry farm it. It's like there's a little bit of rain and the corn is incredibly healthy. They loaned it out to academic institutions only to find 20, 30, 40 years later that those institutions were selling that corn. The Mohawk of Northern New York, a few hundred years back, gave their white corn to settlers. That white corn is now the genetic basis of Monsanto's super crop of GMO pesticide-resistant corn. Mm-hmm. So these groups that have nurtured these relatives and have offered them with love have seen those relatives destroyed genetically and then commodified. So mm-hmm. when it came to doing this movie, it was really a conversation between myself and a group out of Longmont, Colorado, called the First Nations Development Institute. We kind of chatted about this movie before anybody had the idea of doing it. And as we chatted about it, you know, I explained my perspective as somebody coming from East India, where my teacher, Sri Chinmoy, and my father both grew up in British occupied India and really fought against that oppression and that colonization. And we discussed how important it was to have natives on the crew and natives producing the movie, because it was really those producers and executive producers that gave us as filmmakers the access we would need, made mm-hmm. the introductions, you know, basically gave us a calling card to roam through certain tribal areas and meet people and eventually include them in the movie.
Yeah, like it almost legitimizes you. I picture like the, this is perhaps a terrible analogy, but like the mob and like, when you're introducing someone, you're like, no, this is my guy. And then the rest of the mob is like, oh, okay, like Sanjay's good. Like you were like a made man of sorts.
I mean, that's definitely a really good analogy. The difficult thing is that, you know, I couldn't make a mistake. This is why the analogy is really good. Because it's like, if I made a mistake, if I was a made man from like Miami working in Chicago, yeah, you know, kaboom.
Bad things happen.
Not that that would have happened here, but it's like the trust was something I really had to value.
Mm. And you took it seriously, I imagine.
Well, you know, you're dealing with people who are still experiencing the long-term effects of ongoing genocidal policy in the United States. You know, when the first colonists came over, both the pilgrims on the civil side and the military on the English side in Jamestown, Virginia, the Spanish, et cetera, the only economy that the world knew was extractive land-based. It meant that you harvested timber, you harvested animals, you harvested cash crops, right? Like, you know, the colonists were trying to grow sugar in Hispaniola, in the Caribbean. They were then trying to farm tobacco and cotton to export in massive quantity. And you don't really care about the health of the land because you're just trying to get what you can out of it. Mm. And when they came to the New World, it wasn't that the land was wild. There were farms everywhere. It's like Native Americans were growing stuff. They were hunting. They had an exquisite system of food management and food ecology. So the colonists ran them off that land and started planting cash crops. Those cash crops depleted the land and forced colonists to move further and further and further west. Mm-hmm. So when you look at this extractive economy that drove the creation of America and understand that the land was always what was valuable, natives were pushed off that land and in many cases to reservations that, I'm using air quotes, that weren't their ancestral land. It was new land that they had to relearn. And the irony is oftentimes that land was terrible for farming, but as the Industrial Revolution hit and energy came from petroleum sources and you needed wacky minerals to really power these industrialized machines and economies, the junky land that natives were given, the rocky, unfarmable land, happened to be replete with these other newfound forms of wealth. But that's been stripped from them too. So it's like there's nothing that this extractive economy would like more than unceded access or unencumbered access to their land.
Still.
Still.
Yeah.
So still, it's like natives might have the reservations, but it's like the U.S. government still owns everything below those reservations. So in Nebraska, for example, tribes that have land that had oil discoveries in the late 1800s are still being paid prices that were negotiated by the U.S. government in the late 1800s. So companies might be pulling out oil or it's gasoline at, you know, $2-3 per gallon, and the people on whose land that is are getting less than a penny per gallon because the price was negotiated in the 1800s. And the U.S. controls that entire relationship still.
That's infuriating.
Yeah, and so, and that's just the tip. It's like, you know, natives are pushed so far away from urban centers and they were pushed so far away from railroads that they're no longer, or they're not on food supply chains. So couple that with the lack of economic opportunity, it means they get really junky calories at really high prices. So the only thing you can afford is Cheetos. And the government by treaty is giving you, you know, commodity food, basically, you know, boxes of food every week, but it's like government cheese, it's canned milk, it's canned meat, canned salmon, gallons of oil. So you've been taken off your ancestral land. There's other insidious things that have happened that would strip people from their cultures and destroy their language, destroy their knowledge, and you're given food that's meant to kill you, and you're expected to survive and to thrive. It's their unrealistic expectations.
Mm. I think that's a good segue into the trauma aspect of the film, because it seemed like that was sort of the underbelly of the story, was that these people who are doing incredible things, very innovative things in the present day, are still having to work through this institutionalized kind of trauma through no fault of their own that is now part of who they are and their communities.
Yeah, so like starting in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, Native kids were forcibly kidnapped from their parents and put into boarding schools, the point of which was to Christianize, Americanize the kids, make them forget their native languages. They were punished if they spoke their native languages, and they didn't get the traditional kind of discipleship from elders that they would have in their ancestral societies. So wisdom wasn't passed on. And those boarding schools continued in that form through the 70s. It wasn't until 1977 that the Supreme Court basically overturned the permission that people had to go into Indian country and basically steal kids to put them into foster homes and into schools. So you've got, and you would imagine really bad stuff happened at those boarding schools. So you have a kid that comes back to the reservation after those boarding schools who's holding that trauma, who doesn't understand why his family or her family even allowed that to happen. Obviously there was no choice, and is trying to start a life again on the reservation. No job, the food isn't conducive to mental health. You know how bad you feel if you drink Coke and eat chips all day. It's like, imagine if that was your diet, you'd feel terrible all the time. You'd be angry, irritable, couple that with trauma. And then you turn to alcohol, you turn to drugs, you turn to domestic violence, and you then put the next generation into that same cycle. And so what is needed to break those cycles of violence when you don't have economic opportunity? You don't really have opportunity to educate yourself. You don't really have a sense of who you are. The characters in Gather, particularly Chef Nephi Craig from the White Mountain Apache tribe, Twyla Cassador, a master forager from the San Carlos Apache tribe, both in Arizona, they had to go through those transformations themselves. You know, they turned to alcoholism, they turned to self-destructive behaviors, but they realized that their pathway out was through food. And it was through practicing food harvesting the way their ancestors did, which meant going out into the wild and spending hours out in the wilderness. I mean, that's healing in and of itself. You know, doing these very meditative activities, like picking certain herbs for hours and hours and hours on end, And then the life-giving forces of those natural foods and finding ways to recreate ancient Apache recipes gave them a cultural purpose. And they're able to transmit that knowledge to the next generation to veer kids away from trauma or to pull kids out of trauma by telling them what it means to be an Apache. Mm. To be an Apache, it means to have an intimate relationship with Mother Earth, such that you can spend hours out in Mother Earth and you learn to understand her rhythms. You learn to understand the rhythms of animals. You learn to understand the rhythms of plants and birds so that you can harvest the food that Mother Earth wants you to have at the right time. And that whole system of foodways involves deep spirituality, prayer, you know, paying gratitude to offering gratitude to the elements, to Mother Earth. It involves ceremonies based around developing the spiritual qualities of intuition, of gratitude, of love that you need to be able to recognize the signs of Mother Earth. And it gives you the power to basically direct your own life and pull away from temptations, distractions, and destruction.
Mm. Yeah, well said. I think I just keep going back to that phrase, forcibly kidnapped. And that was official government policy at that time?
Yeah, well, you know, that was also a thread in the previous movie, 3100 Run and Become, where our main Navajo character, Sean Martin, in that movie was trying to recreate a run that his dad had to undertake. Now, Sean is an ultramarathoner. He ran it, but the path that he chose was the one that his dad from the age of 6 onwards would take annually, escaping the boarding school that he was forced to go into. And that was a 110-mile journey that his dad as a 6-year-old began having to walk. Dad was forcibly kidnapped in the early 60s from his ancestral home in Arizona, taken to this boarding school that was just off of I-40, sort of outside of Flagstaff. Every time he spoke Navajo, he didn't speak English, but every time he spoke Navajo, he was forced his mouth was washed out with soap and he was beaten. So he was forced to learn English and only English. And it was devastating. It's like he didn't have love. He didn't have the cultural connection that really fueled him his first 6 years. And he knew that in order to keep that and get that, he had to escape. So as a 6-year-old, he walked 110 miles through the desert, mainly at night to evade capture. It took him 5 or 6 days. But thousands of Native American kids did that in boarding schools all around the country, and a lot of them died. And the ones that didn't die were left with the deep scars of, in many cases, sexual violence in those boarding schools, forcible beatings, and the idea that the way you were born is not good enough. That your skin color, you know, your hair color, the customs you felt were very much your own, your language, they were not healthy, and they were not conducive to being a man or a woman in the Western ideal of the word.
If that creates a power dynamic from which it's nearly impossible to escape, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happened, you know, in a lot of, you know, colonial territories like India. You know, one of the things that the British were very successful in doing is de-Indianizing India, you know, making people hunger more for the almighty dollar or the almighty rupee than the sense of community that made India. Honestly, India was the richest country in the world for more than 4,000 years. It accounted for more than 25% of the global economy, trade-wise, production-wise, until about 1520, 1530. And then the British came in the mid-1600s. So you look at the values that make a strong traditional society, and those are the same values that you need to grow your own food. Like when your corn is ready, you can't expect to harvest it all on your own. You need everybody to come and help. And in the same turn, like when other people's crops are ready, you would go and help them. When people were going on a hunt for a buffalo, one person couldn't take down a buffalo, much less carry all the meat back to the village. You needed all the people, men and women, to participate in that hunt. And so the idea of hunting and gathering or growing food as a community was exactly that. You needed a community. And imagine how strong we would be as a society if the people who lived within 400 meters of where we live all worked together on growing things, on harvesting things. There wouldn't be, you know, local crime. You know, a lot of issues that people would have in their own homes would be worked out through the physical process of growing and digging and harvesting. So a lot of things that made us strong, namely food as medicine, doesn't just come from like taking the right tinctures from Whole Foods. You know, it comes from like understanding that electric relationship that we have with the entire process of food and how that fuels us as human beings as much as, you know, eating that crisp apple at the end of the supply chain does.
Mm. Was there anything that surprised you during the production of this film or something that you didn't expect to feel or learn?
Well, you know, it's in line with what you, with your observation earlier, that we see a lot of the food system unconsciously or inherently pushing back to this indigenous ideal just for the sake of survival. You know, people mm-hmm. understand that the earth isn't healthy, that we're not healthy if all of our food comes from 3,000 miles away. That there is something deeply nourishing about eating things that are grown in your area and getting to know the people that grow that food. Like you value it more, you can, in this case, you're willing to pay a little bit more because you understand that the long-term benefit outweighs that cost. But to see that, you know, times a thousand, it's, as you know from the movie, and I won't really give it away, we went on a hunt with Master Forager Twyla Cassador for a creature that's only edible or tolerable in the winter. It's an Apache creature called a gloscho. And little creature that lives under cacti and scurries around. And when you see it in the movie, we all have like a big lump in our throat because it's the same kind of animal that populates subways in New York City. People can guess what that is. But living out in the wild, these rodents eat super clean food. And it was a staple food source in the winter for Apache, who in December, January, didn't want to kill elk that were about to get impregnated, didn't want to kill other animals that were in the wrong gestation cycle, and understood that this type of protein in the winter not only had good macros, but these creatures were eating medicinal foods whose lectins were completely undigestible for human beings. But when absorbed chemically into the flesh of these animals, you know, had a medicinal quality. Seeing that local understanding of this local rodent that was only really available to this tribe in a very small period of time each year showed me like, God, in New York City, I'm eating nothing that's grown here. Right? Like, I mean, there's rooftop gardens, but they're growing like the same tomatoes and mescaline lettuce that you get anywhere. Like, what were the crops that the people who lived on the land I live in Queens, the Munsee Indians, the Lakawi Indians from the Lenape bands of natives, what did they eat? What did they harvest? I mean, we know from the first Thanksgiving and from the Mashpee Wampanoag people outside of Plymouth Rock, that first Thanksgiving, like the turkey was the most like, you know, unappetizing thing on the table. They ate lobster. They ate mussels. You know, they ate venison. They ate such a wide variety of food. And I look at my diet and it's like every day it's like sweet potato, sour cream, veggie burger, oatmeal, and a smoothie. There's nothing really that interesting about it.
Yeah, man. I just finished this book called The Overstory. You heard of this book? It's about trees. It's unbelievably good. But at one point, he mentions the idea that Manhattan used to be a forest. And for whatever reason, that just completely stopped me in my tracks. Like, oh, like, of course it did. I understand that. But I've never really considered that as a core sort of tenet of the world. Like, what were the forests like? Like, who lived there? What did they eat? Etc. Like, that's everywhere, though.
I mean, the fascinating thing about the system of ecology in the New World is keeping in mind that you know, we're not talking about like the images we have of like uncontacted tribes in the Amazon. No, no, no harm, no foul, but like coming out in their underwear and like with exotic markings and just a kind of a primitive sense of their identity vis-a-vis other people. You know, we're talking about people and tribes who had lived and traded with each other for tens of thousands of years, who developed this kind of macro level ability to reshape nature all across North America. Buffalo bison ranged from the Yukon all the way down to Florida. That's because natives ensured that their migratory passageways and pathways were always healthy. And in many cases, they created those pathways. You know, they created ways for buffalo to migrate physically in places that they wouldn't have naturally been able to go. When the first Spanish explorers came to the East Coast, they were surprised that they could ride on their 6-foot horses as like 5.5-foot tall men through forests and not have the horses get snagged on branches and their armor gets stuck, you know, in leaves. It's because natives burned. And they created like these exquisitely managed forests that looked wild, that seemed idyllic enough for Europeans to like marvel at the new world being heavenly. But it was because they had a tremendous knowledge of their ecosystem, and none of it, not to say that parts of it weren't dangerous, but none of it was wild. None of it was foreign. It is for us. Like I think of a forest as something foreboding, because I can't recognize food in a forest.
Yeah, the amount of knowledge that indigenous people have as a culture is mind-boggling. I used to teach this master's course in Australia, and as part of that, we're like lucky enough to have this indigenous elder take us through the forest. And when he was saying, like, for us back in the day, the forest was a pharmacy, a university, like a hardware store. It was a playground. It was like everything all at once. And it was interesting to see this man just point at anything and be like, oh yeah, you can make soap out of that. Or, oh, that has red berries in the summertime. And, oh, that, like, it was both incredibly impressive, but also I felt this deep sense of unworthiness or of like, I know literally nothing about anything.
I mean, there was a particular reason why the colonial powers went to West Africa to start harvesting human beings. And the slaves they were bringing over weren't laborers of a random sort. They came from agrarian societies. You wanted people that had hundreds of years of experience with plants to grow your cash crops. If you thought you were going to become a zillionaire off of cotton, you weren't just going to put people out in the field. You're going to put people out in the field that understood the dirt, that understood the earth. And those societies of slaves brought a lot of traditions, but they brought a mentality of understanding that food was medicine, that despite the lack of quality calories they would get from their slave masters, they could recognize medicine in the woods. And post 13th Amendment, post Reconstruction, you see a lot of societies in the South, predominantly African-American farming societies, despite all the horrific racism that they continued to endure, you know, they had a deep understanding of the medicinal qualities of plants. Like cherry trees weren't just prized for the cherries that they could harvest once a year and, you know, obviously preserve, et cetera, but the bark had value, the roots had value, you know, other elements had value, and they would make medicine out of it. So they looked at the ecosystem they lived in, not just as a source of calories, but as a source of real health. And you're right. Like I was with Twyla when she was walking through Central Park. Again, she's from Arizona. Central Park is one of the most manicured parks in the world, at least in my mind. She was pulling leaves off of plants, pulling up some plants by the root because they had food and medicinal value. Like she recognized it. There's food all around us. We just have no idea. There's medicine all around us. It's just much easier for us to go into a store and read a label than to go into a park and pull out dandelions.
Yeah, precisely. I was walking the other day down the road with my girlfriend, who's like a trained like nutrition school, all that, like the healthiest person I know. And I like pointed at a weed and I was like, that looks like a dandelion. She's like, yeah, it is. And I was like, but like in Whole Foods, that's like $6. But it's just literally growing in the sidewalk crack right there.
Yeah.
Seems surreal.
Yeah. People will pay $2 an ounce for a dandelion root. They'll pay, you know, $2 an ounce for a dried dandelion leaf.
Yeah.
$6 for a bunch of dandelions. And you go like, these things grow everywhere.
They're not weeds.
But in my yard in New York City, I have two gigantic mullein plants. I mean, they look crazy. And mullein was one and continues to be one of the most important coronavirus symptom related herb, because it really heals bronchial passageways and opens up and reduces inflammation in the lungs. And people go to the health store around the corner from me, spend $14 for an ounce of tincture. And I've got these plants in my front yard.
Yeah.
They're massive. Like if I harvested half of one plant, I would have enough tincture for myself for a whole year.
Yeah.
Again, I'm lazy. I buy the tincture.
Yeah, that's fair. And so like, how do we change things? How do we change the world, Sanjay? Like I see your movie is so inspiring and there's so much work to be done and there's a tremendous amount of knowledge not being utilized and there's so many people that could benefit from this. And it's like, duh.
So on the political answer is easy. The political answer is like support policies that support Indian country. Learn about the policies that they're fighting against, you know, follow the all the political, you know, indigenous accounts in whatever country you're in, Canada, the US, Australia. But then also, you know, recognizing that there luckily isn't really any sort of movement to ask all of us on unceded land to move back to where we came from. It's understanding that we first and foremost have a responsibility to Earth as stewards. You know, Sri Chinmoy, my teacher, said that we have to be humble to Mother Earth. We have to show Mother Earth our humility. Mm. What does that mean? You know, really to cultivate that specific relationship. It's not even gratitude. It's like even on a level deeper than gratitude. Because gratitude's like, I can offer that once a day and I feel like I'm okay.
Yeah.
But you're not humble if you're a jerk 80% of the day and you're nice 20% of the day. So what does it mean to cultivate humility towards Mother Earth? From a capitalist standpoint, understanding that we're all capitalists, it's understanding how much destruction our extraction causes and that our extractive relationship with Mother Earth isn't humble. And it doesn't make us stewards of the land. It makes us destroyers of the land. And that extractive relationship with Mother Earth is really only going to hasten the destruction of human beings. You know, we've seen in 145 years of the Industrial Revolution, we're pretty much on the precipice of destroying a 4 billion year old Earth, or let's say a 200 million year old life-serving ecosystem. So I think the one thing for non-natives to learn from this movie and to ask themselves is, how can we be better stewards of the place that we're living on?
Mm.
You know, how can we be understanding of our role, even in a big city, of the fact that we live on a living, breathing planet? I mean, in 3100 Run and Become, Sean Martin, our Navajo character, says that when Navajo run, they feel that their feet are praying to Mother Earth. They're breathing in Father Sky. They're asking them for their blessings and they're showing them that they're willing to work for those blessings. So understanding that we do have a fundamental need for the blessings of Mother Earth, and what does that mean on a day-to-day calorie by calorie basis? It might be just as simple as like eating less meat. It might be as simple as like buying less bottled water. Trying to do things that might not be easy, like getting a water filter as opposed to buying cases of bottled water and filling up your bottles every day, but like a lot of little things amount to becoming a good steward, not one big grand action every day, like simply driving hybrid.
Yeah.
And doing everything else bad. Hybrid owners are great. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Teslas are great.
Yeah.
We support Teslas in this podcast.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, we underestimate our own personal impact, truly. And it seems like that was one of the themes that I liked about your film, was that you kind of linked personal transformation with cultural transformation and healing in a community. So each of these individual characters have gone through their own stuff that sort of come out the other side and are doing things to help spread that healing to others.
Yeah. And like we're not unfamiliar with that concept as Westerners. You know, most of us know that most of us have done diets before, whether it's like dieting to lose weight. And that means ultimately feeling better about oneself. If it's a permanent diet to, you know, affect a bad health outcome, we know that's going to make us happy. We know that food can be medicine, but what does it mean to have food not just as a medicine for our body or for our psychology, but for something deeper, like for something like truly universal, and not just, you know, I'm a vegan or I eat the paleo diet because I think it's the only diet anybody in the whole world should eat. It's not that kind of self-serving identity. But how can my food choices connect me to something much larger than my own finite self? And it seems crazy that food can be God, but in India we say Anam Brahma. It's a mantra. Food is God. And you repeat that, you know, before you eat any meal. That's kind of like a Sanskrit invocation. If you feel like you're eating God, and that God is nourishing your body so that your soul can make more progress towards the infinite, then, oh my goodness, you have a totally different relationship with food and the food system.
Yeah, you just kind of short-circuited my brain there. I've never thought of it that way. That is food God? And yeah, that's good.
I mean, we know from an Eastern perspective, everything is God, but the more conscious we are of these different elements of the finite and how they relate to our own search for self and our own pathway to self-discovery, you can't have a spiritual life if your body is in pain. You can't sit and meditate. You can't pray with the type of focus that you need to pull your identity away from your physical body and experience transcendence. So it's like what we put into our body as 10-year-olds or as 90-year-olds is critical for our own personal relationship with the universe and our personal sense of happiness. And we find through traditional cultures, like looking at what's really alive in Indian country right now, that relationship with food can't also be as selfish as it sounds. It can't be like, I'm going to eat this diet so that I can feel good and I can, you know, achieve a certain goal. It's an understanding that if our ultimate goal is to absolve ourselves of ego or to expand our sense of self to something that's truly universal, why not have that humility to begin with? And that's that kind of aphorism that, you know, we must be, you know, extremely humble, or we must show Mother Earth our utmost humility.
Yeah, it's almost like that link between spirituality and sovereignty and humility and connectiveness between all of us. It's like a kind of core values of your work, at least in my sample size of two movies.
Well, the exact quote from Sri Chinmoy was, Mother Earth has to be treated with utmost humility. Mother Earth has to be treated with utmost humility. I mean, in a sense, that's the way Mother Earth treats us, right?
Yeah.
Like, we destroy everything. And if Earth wasn't humble, you know, she'd just flick us off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big idea. that I think is super powerful.
It's such a grounding one right away. Mm. If you say, like, what does it mean to treat Mother Earth with utmost humility? You start feeling like you're walking on a living being.
Mm.
You know, it's like if you walked on a loved one, man, woman, or child, you know, who loved you, you would do it very tenderly.
Yeah.
You know,
And I think too, the other powerful link is that you are part of Mother Earth. Like you are part of the universe. You are stardust, right? And so then it's like to be humble with yourself and treat yourself with the love and respect that you deserve as something sacred and profound. Anyway, we're going down a rabbit hole at the end of the podcast. Next time we have to lead with that one, Sanjay. Any final words of wisdom? Anything we haven't covered?
I can't think of anything. You know, I'm always grateful for our conversations because we get to a place where I go, oh my God, I hadn't thought of things that way before.
I feel like so, I was the only one.
Oh yeah, like I can't, I'm going to have to make another movie real quick.
Yeah. Are you working on anything at the moment?
No, I'm just trying to get this film the momentum that I think it deserves. So
That's fair. Has your work professionally been affected by this pandemic? Like, are people making movies? Can you get crews together to create art? Like, you can't travel?
In a word, no. We finished all the technical aspects of Gather literally about 10 days before New York shut down in March.
Wow.
And obviously distribution for movies has radically shifted.
Mm.
No one's going to theaters. We can't do the community screenings we would have done. That's not really affecting our distribution into the quote Western world, but a lot of Indian country reservations, they don't have good bandwidth. Mm. So it's been difficult trying to get the film there. So we've just gone old school and it's like DVD and US Postal Service.
Yeah.
So it's opened up opportunities. It's also opened up some challenges. But hey, I mean, this is the smallest issue that I think I could ever hope for in a global pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I love your movies. And if you're listening, I encourage you to check them out. They're definitely filmed and shot with heart, about heartfelt topics that are important and powerful. And I just want to thank you for your work. I respect and admire it, man.
I appreciate yours exactly the same way. You know, without folks like you, you know, a lot of us wouldn't have that kind of like bellwether.
Bellwether.
Yeah, I'm grateful for how you challenge us and how you inspire us. So yeah.
Yeah. Both thank ways. You, brother. Well, if you if and when you create more, you you always have a place at this podcast. I love our chats. I just adore your vibe, your spirit. I think it's really needed right now, especially with people asking powerful questions about important topics in a world that is kind of ebbing and flowing in various ways. So I think your art is really special. So thanks for being here. And I'll talk to you soon, my man.
Great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Joy Canada. Lucky.
's a big ideas guy, right? I've included links in the show notes to all of his information. You can check out the movie Gather. You can check out his old film called 3100. They're both great. They're just really touching and heartwarming films. As usual, thank you for being here. Thanks for listening, for the 5-star reviews, for sharing me. If you want to learn more about me, you can find me on Instagram at longdistancelovebombs. I've got a monthly membership program called Team Never Giver Upper. I send a weekly email. I've got this podcast. Done more than 90 episodes now, so if you're looking for new stuff to get in your ear bones, have a scroll through the old ones. Check out ones that you haven't quite listened to just yet, or maybe a few new names pops out. New names pop out. Yeah, I've got that verb tense right. You're the best. I adore you. I appreciate you, and thanks for being here.